Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Coming up later on the show, we're going to hear from some of the people behind the new film Nomadland, including its star, Frances McDormand, plus my interview with writer-director Miranda July, whose new movie, Kajillionaire, starring Evan Rachel Wood, is out this week. But first, joining us to review this week's new releases are Leo Lowenstein, film critic for KPCC and film columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press, and Christy Lemire, film critic for KPCC and RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. A quick housekeeping note before we get started, there are some films this week that are screening at indoor theaters that have reopened in Orange County. We are not suggesting or endorsing that anyone go see a film at an indoor theater, but anyone who decides to do so should consult COVID-19 protocols from the CDC, your local public health agency, and the theater where you're going to see the film. Now, on to the reviews. We're going to start with Kajillionaire. It's a comedic drama about a family of small-time con artists who are trying to get by in L.A. It stars Evan Rachel Wood, Deborah Winger, Gina Rodriguez, and Richard Jenkins. Miranda July directs and wrote the screenplay. Christy, why don't you get us going?
This is just a wonderfully surreal and strange and singular and ultimately sweet story. It's a very L.A. story, although it's simultaneously rooted in a realistic L.A., but it's also just this weirdo, far-out, dreamlike version of L.A. as well. And that's the beauty of Miranda July, is that she can function on both of those levels so beautifully at once. So Richard Jenkins and Deborah Winger and Evan Rachel Wood play this family of con artists. They are barely getting by. They are like living day by day. They live in like a bizarre office building with cubicles where it fills up with pink soap bubbles every day in the afternoon at the same time. It's just an odd place. And then on one of their many scams, they come across Gina Rodriguez, who is like ready to jump in and join them. This is the only like little contrivance here that maybe is not quite right, but she's such a delight that you're happy to have her join in the gig here. So Gina Rodriguez joins in and becomes part of their little family of scam artists. And her introduction into their dynamic, which has been going on for like a quarter of a century now, shakes everything up for everybody and forces them all to reevaluate their relationship, but especially Evan Rachel Wood. And there's such delightful and odd and like delicate sweetness to the friendship that develops between Evan Rachel Wood and Gina Rodriguez. Because what Evan Rachel Wood is doing here, she's so withdrawn. She's so introverted and so awkward. And the voice she's doing is this deep, weird register. And everything about her is just kind of awkward and off. And Gina Rodriguez is just sunshine personified. And that the way they change each other is so cool. So it's a really, really weird movie, but also ultimately a really sweet and human one.
Leo?
Well said, Christy. It's also very much a Miranda July movie. And to me, what that means, thinking really back to me and you and everyone we know, is that it centers on these incredibly quirky, idiosyncratic characters who don't adhere to any sort of social norms, really, or paradigms that you could possibly expect. And to that end, it does that extremely well. You cannot apply sort of ordinary logic to a Miranda July movie, or you will be immensely frustrated. But it is funny, it's weird. Like Christy said, this is about very, very low-level grifters so low that they, you know, their regular scam is to rob adjacent post boxes at the post office when they know that the mail person is not watching the box. So, you know, it's that low level. And so their scams are weird and not entirely largely remunerative, but they're creative and they're odd. And so, you know, yes, like Christy said, this evolving relationship between Evan Rachel Wood, who's this child, you know, who never felt nurtured, and Gina Rodriguez, who is just sunshine, really kind of makes the picture. And it's weird, it's funny, it's definitely way, way offbeat and off the beaten path.
And I think years from now, it would make a great double bill with Bong Joon-ho's Parasite. It's also really well made. There's a scene where the family goes to visit somebody who is old and dying, and it is about a five-minute scene, and it's one of the best scenes of any movie this year. Kajillionaire stars Evan Rachel Wood. It's in wide release, playing in Orange County theaters. You can also watch the film at the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair, the Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside, and the Rubidoux Drive-In in Riverside. Later on in the hour, stay tuned for my interview with writer and director Miranda July. Up next is the Netflix drama Enola Holmes. It stars Millie Bobby Brown of Stranger Things fame, with Henry Cavill and Sam Claflin. Helena Bonham Carter also stars. The film is rated PG-13, and it's the feature directing debut for Harry Bradbeer. Lael, why don't you get us started?
Sure. So Enola Holmes, played by Millie Bobby Brown, is the teen sister of Sherlock Holmes, and you know, the lesser known of the Holmes siblings, we'll say. And she points out very early on that her name Enola spells backwards alone. And that is essentially where she finds herself in life. Her mother, played by Helena Bonham Carter, is missing, and she needs to find her. In that mission, she drafts her brothers, and she goes on this incredibly kind of labyrinthine, clever and funny journey. It's very difficult. Millie Bobby Brown is so perfectly cast here, and she uses her wits and her cleverness to decode and solve the mystery of where her mother is. There's a few bits of it that I didn't care for as much. Like there were some shifts that I thought could have been maybe better and more thoroughly explained. But really gorgeous cinematography, really well acted, and you know, pretty entertaining all around. Nice to see the Distaff Holmes for once.
Christy.
So if you watch Stranger Things, you know what Millie Bobby Brown can do, and you know that she's had this like poise and presence beyond her years for many years now, but there's such a darkness and such responsibility on her shoulders on that show. And here, all that presence exists, but she is just a delight. I mean, she gets to be joyful, and she is radiant and effervescent and has incredible comic timing. One thing about Stranger Things, she does not get to be funny. And here she absolutely does. It's a really hyperverbal performance. It's a lot of fourth wall breaking and talking directly to the camera. Harry Bradbeer, who directed it, did most of the episodes of Fleabag. And so it very much has that same kind of structure where she's making really self-aware asides to the camera. And from the very beginning, you're just hooked. Yeah, she is a delight. Henry Cavill as like the hunkiest Sherlock Holmes ever. I don't know how he finds time to go to the gym between solving crimes, but he does. And then Helena Bonham Carter is really perfect casting as Millie Bobby Brown's mom. They look quite a bit alike. They both got sort of an unconventional presence about them. She's the coolest homeschool mom ever. She's great inspiration for all of us who are stuck at home trying to teach our kids, because they play like archery and tennis indoors. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's a little overlong. It's based on a young adult novel by Nancy Springer. It's a little overlong at just over 2 hours, and it gets kind of weirdly violent toward the end in a way that's sort of jarring from the whimsical family-friendly adventure we've seen beforehand. But it's a lot of fun, so definitely a good thing to watch with your older kids at home.
Enola Holmes is the name of the film. It stars Millie Bobby Brown, Henry Cavill, and Sam Claflin. It's the feature directing debut for Harry Bradbeer. The film is rated PG-13, and you can see it on Netflix. Now, the British comedic drama Misbehavior, based on the true story of the 1970 Miss World pageant. It stars Keira Knightley, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, and Jesse Buckley. The film is directed by Philippa Lorthope. Christy, why don't you get us going?
I had no idea this had happened. This is a true story. This is what happened at the 1970 Miss World pageant in London. And it's about how a group of women who were part of the women's rights movement going on then plot this elaborate yet rough-hewn plan to disrupt the pageant, because they feel like it stands for just the objectification of women, that it keeps them in a certain place where, you know, men are still dominant and just icky in their lascivious praise of them. I mean, the way that the announcer describes these pageant contestants made me just cringe. It's just so, it's so sexist and it's so archaic. But, you know, back then, this was very family-friendly entertainment. And so from little kids to grandparents, you could sit in front of the TV together and watch the Miss World pageant. So in this particular year, a group of activists led by Keira Knightley and Jessie Buckley. Jessie Buckley is amazing, by the way. She can just do everything. And she's got this incredible naturalism and this accessibility about her. They are part of a group that plots to sabotage the pageant. And it's kind of like Miss Congeniality meets Mrs. America, because you have, you know, the very staid traditional pageant world, but also the rush and the thrill and the energy of the women's rights movement. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's a very traditional kind of feel-good British comedy. That's a really specific subgenre where it's based on a true story, but it's lighthearted and it's not going to really dig too deep and push too hard, but it's going to make a statement in a way that's lovely and warm and cozy. This is that. Greg Kinnear is very good as Bob Hope, totally skeevy, lascivious Bob Hope in this. So I enjoyed it.
Leo?
Yeah, everything that Christy said. This is also a nice film to watch with some maybe older children. I watched it with, I can't call them children, a couple of 18-year-old young women, and we all thoroughly enjoyed it. Like Christy, I knew nothing of this historical event, and I don't know if like Christy, but I grew up watching pageants and, you know, loving them. From this perspective, you know, now in 2020, it's quite a different thing. To look both at the sort of hideousness of the beauty pageants and what they represent, and also to see kind of the real kind of feminist breakthrough of these women at this time as depicted in this film. I want to give a shout out to Keira Knightley, who is, you know, I don't think I've ever seen her so good, so sort of just brazen and you know, unfettered in her expression. And Jessie Buckley also was absolutely terrific. I also really enjoyed Gugu Mbatha-Raw, who played Miss Grenada. Just really wonderful performances all around. Greg Kinnear, Leslie Manville as Bob Hope's wife. And yes, there was an incredible amount of lasciviousness in the comments that were made both by the original host of the pageant. And I don't actually know if this is something Bob Hope said, but it precipitates one of the final revolts at the end of the film, where he's talking about, he's reading from cue cards. He's talking about, you know, women's feelings and women's rights, because it's news at this point that the event is being criticized by these ruffian women. And he says, you know, women's feelings, I care about women's feelings. Yeah, I want to feel women all the time. And that's when the women kind of lose it. It's this trigger moment. And, you know, it's really, you know, again, seen from this perspective today, it's really, it just really hits home. At the same time, and this is not to contradict the message of the film, the costumes are amazing. And, you know, watching it with these young women, we were saying, wow, I really love the costumes. I also like the message. Is it okay to feel that way? You know, to feel, is that contradictory to like both? And we decided it is okay. And it's really a quite a worthwhile film. I hope that people take a look at it.
Misbehavior is unrated. It's available to rent and buy on video on demand platforms, including iTunes, Amazon Prime Video, and more. Next, and quickly, you have 30 seconds for this one. The Artist's Wife is the drama by director Tom Dolby. He co-wrote the film with Abdi Nazemian and Nicole Brending. It's rated R and stars Lena Olin and Bruce Dern. Leo, why don't you go in 30?
Okay, this was a really beautiful portrait of a relationship about a narcissistic abstract expressionist played by Bruce Dern, who is suffering from Alzheimer's and has to have a reunion with his adult daughter. And it was really predictable, but beautifully acted, and I thought really quite moving.
Christy, very quickly.
Beautifully acted. Lena Olin has such grace and such dignity and gets to wear amazing sweaters. It's predictable. It reminded me of that film The Wife with Glenn Close from about a year ago. Lovely acting, but that's about it.
Artist's Wife is rated R. It's available on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. More reviews are just ahead on Film Week. We'll hear about the documentary Push about skyrocketing housing prices and the cost of urban living, the drama Inez, Doug, and Kira from first-time director Julia Knotts, back in just a minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle, and we're joined by our Film Week critics, Leo Lowenstein, film columnist for the Santa Monica Daily Press, and Chrissy Lemire, film critic for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. We continue our reviews this week with The Disrupted. It's a documentary directed by Sarah Colt and Josh Gleason. The film follows three different people trying to make a living and find their place in the U.S. economy. Christy?
It's a totally depressing but really necessary and really eye-opening film about just people being left behind in our current economy, in our evolving economy. You have a farmer in Kansas who's in his early 60s, who's had this land and his family for generations, but he's in massive debt and he has health problems and he doesn't know what to do about that. Do you pass it on to your sons? Do you sell it and try to pay off the debt? So he's in a place of real flux. There's a gentleman who's maybe in his 40s who has lost his job at a 3M factory in Northern Ohio when it shuts down. And he is trying to start over again and maybe wants to get a job working in HVAC. He doesn't want to work for anybody anymore, but he's got debt and he's got kids and grandkids. And then you have a woman in Tampa, Florida, who is an Uber driver. And she had been in the brokerage business, but then that all fell apart with the economic collapse of 2008. And so you've got these three people in very different industries, all of which are, you know, theoretically the quote unquote forgotten men and women that Trump campaigned on. And in the ensuing years, not only have their lives not gotten better, they've gotten significantly worse. And they are struggling financially and emotionally and physically. And they don't really ever say the name Trump. You see him in the in a TV clip briefly, but that presence is unmistakable, the undercurrent of, you know, within the malaise that they are all experiencing. And so it's how they struggle to survive and how they try to find answers and try to reinvent themselves when they're, you know, later in life and later in their careers. And I'm sure that a lot of folks watching it all over the country will see themselves in it.
It sounds a lot like a film I'm going to talk about later in the show, Nomadland, that doesn't come out till later in the year, about displacement. Disrupted is available to watch on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The documentary is written and directed by Sarah Colt and Josh Gleason, and it is unrated. Now, the drama Inez and Doug and Kira. It's directed by Julia Knotts, who makes her feature directing debut. Christy, why don't you start with this one?
Gosh, okay, this is hard to explain without giving stuff away. I'm going to try real hard. So it jumps back and forth in time. It begins at a funeral, and it's a man and a woman, and it's Doug and Kira at this point who are engaged to each other. Kira's twin sister Inez, her sororal twin sister Inez, has killed herself. And that inspires Doug, who had a intertwined and kind of codependent relationship with Inez, to go back and try to figure out what happened. She left no note. And Doug and Kira, in their own ways, revisit their relationship with Inez and with each other. Doug and Inez met in AA, and so addiction and codependency is a big theme here. It's really beautifully acted. I love all three performances. I really love Michael Chernus in this because he's not in any way a traditional leading man, either in his looks or in his demeanor, but he's got impeccable technique and so subtle here, the way he navigates all the emotions that he is called upon to show. I really like this movie. It's edited very well because it's jumping around in time, but never in a way that's confusing or alienating. It's all momentum, forward momentum in telling the story.
Leo?
That's a good point, Christy. I think that kind of elliptical editing could have been really annoying. And often, you know, when reviewing a film, if it privileges like editing for the sake of being experimental, if it's a narrative film, it can be really irritating. But in this film, it worked really well. That is also true of the performances and Julia Kotz's directing, which I think really creates a sort of unifying undercurrent, and sort of beautifully puts together this film, making it look kind of more almost lush than it was. It was, I think, shot on pretty much a shoestring. You can tell that because there are very, very limited locations. And it's a very tight little story, but it's quite hypnotic and really hooks you in, and you're sort of trying to figure it out the whole time. So I thought it was really pretty, pretty good.
Inez and Doug and Kira is the film. It's from director Julia Knotts. It's unrated, and you can catch it on video on demand platforms, including iTunes and Vudu. We continue our reviews this week with Push. It's a documentary directed by Frederick Gerton, which explores why housing prices have skyrocketed around the world and why urban living is so expensive. Christy.
Like The Disrupted, also a total bummer. However, very enlightening as well, and it shines a light on what is happening in major cities all over the world where, like, mom and pop stores and longtime local businesses and just apartments where families have lived for generations, everyone's getting pushed out. And the way it's shot and from the opening titles, it really grabs you. It's very innovative in the visual context in which it puts all these stories. And so the filmmaker follows this woman, Leilani Farha, who is a journalist, and she also works with, like, UN human rights stuff. From, like, Barcelona to London to Berlin, and then in New York City as well, cities all over the world where it's just impossible to live affordably. And so what's happening is, like, giant corporations are coming in and just buying up huge city blocks of apartments and then maybe just letting them sit there empty, either pushing the people out who live there outright, evicting them, or raising the rent to an extent that they couldn't possibly afford to live there. And then it's like a future that they're just betting on, right? And they don't care if it actually creates community. It's destroying communities. And so the film is about this trend and how cynical that is and how sad that is. And it's really eye-opening. I had no idea that was happening, but it is indeed. And I don't really know what to do about it.
And then it's not happening in places like Silicon Valley or resort cities like Aspen. It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, huge major cities all over the world. London, Barcelona, Berlin, Stockholm, Seoul, South Korea, and also New York. Yeah.
The documentary is called Push. It's directed by Frederick Gerton. The film is unrated, and you can see it on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Now, Ottolenghi and the Cakes of Versailles. It's a documentary, maybe not as depressing as the one we've talked about already. It's from director Laura Gabbert, and it follows celebrity chef Yotam Ottolenghi as he assembles a team of the world's most innovative pastry chefs to put on a Versailles-themed culinary gala at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. Lael, I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. What can you tell us about the movie?
Well, first, let me a little disclaimer, because as I was watching the film, which is quite sumptuous visually and has some of the most amazing decadent food you could even imagine, John, I thought, wow, could there be any more inappropriate escapism at a time, at this time when we've got so much going on in our world and so much social unrest and we've got COVID and we've got, systemic racism and, it felt wrong a little bit to be watching this.
A little too much Let Them Eat Cake?
Well, a little bit, which, by the way, apparently, according to this film, was an apocryphal statement. And I looked it up. So this must be the fact. Marie Antoinette allegedly really did not say Let Them Eat Cake. She was, misquoted and that statement was applied to her. But certainly it has become associated with her. What I found fascinating about this doc, aside from the fact that I love most food movies, and there's a whole extensive list of them that, one should see, this was a really interesting portrait of Ottolenghi, who is an Israeli English chef who has brought a kind of structure and rigor to the gastronomy. And also it's a really in-depth portrait of these five pastry chefs that he hires to assemble this event. So this was for the history of Versailles at the Met, a few years ago, it also could not seem more inappropriate now to be looking at people gathering, all these people gathering in an enclosed space, you know, but this incredibly opulent, decadent food. And also to hear each of these sous chefs, these pastry chefs, talk about the philosophy behind how they prepare their pastry. And there's some of them studied architecture, some of them studied dance, most of them had some kind of a career before they became a chef. And you know, the discussion about what went into this and the cultural history, the philosophy, the thinking about, you know, how Versailles was, certainly the gardens of Versailles were really about man kind of mastering nature, like creating this really structured and rigorous and exacting kind of space, and how that all started to crumble at the end, right before the, or right around the time of the French Revolution. It was really, really fascinating and absolutely a feast for the eyes and made me mouth-wateringly hungry. And, you know, it's certainly beautiful to see and reminds me of a bygone time. I also love Laura Gabbert, the director. She did a film called Sunset Story a few years ago that I liked very much. So this was a much more penetrating than I expected it to be. Really quite a good doc.
And I think it is fair to say that Marie Antoinette did not say let them eat cake. She would have said gâteau because she was speaking in French. So we have that corrected now. The film is called Ottolenghi and the Cakes of Versailles. The film is directed by Laura Gabbert and can be seen on video on demand and at select theaters. You can check your local listings. LX2048 or 2048 is a sci-fi drama. It's written and directed by Guy Mosha and it stars James Darcy and Delroy Lindo. Christy.
This is such a weird movie and it's so ambitious and it's trying to do so much. So I'm going to try to describe it to you. So it's the near future, but it doesn't feel all that far away because the beginning of it is James Darcy in like head to toe hazmat gear driving his convertible across the 4th Street Bridge into downtown LA, and it's totally desolate. He's the only guy in his office. It's just all empty cubicles and an empty conference room. So it kind of feels eerily relevant. Like we are all this guy. It's a futuristic Los Angeles, but again, it's you can recognize it, but it's also a little off, kind of like Repo Man. It's got some Repo Man to it. But it's also got some Blade Runner to it because it's about clones and VR and bringing virtual people to life and the ethical quandaries around that. The sun has gotten so bright and so toxic that people can't go out in the daytime. They only go out at night. James Darcy, in the middle of that, is finding out that he has a serious health problem and wonders whether to allow his clone to take over his life. There's a lot going on here. And then Delroy Lindo is the guy with the technology who created all of this stuff. And he's got some amusing moments. I almost feel like this needs to be a whole series because it's really ambitious and really specific and really strange. But even in the space of like an hour and 45 minutes, it's like it's trying to get so much in. I really like James Darcy in this though, because he eventually has to play two different versions of himself, which are definite and specific from each other, although he's the same guy and that's tough. So I enjoyed it, but I also feel like, man, there's a lot going on and maybe too much.
LX2048 is the film. It's written and directed by Guy Mosha. It's unrated and available to rent and buy on video on demand platforms, including iTunes, Fandango Now, and Vudu. Before we break, we wanted to take a moment to remember Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died at the age of 87 last week. This week, theaters and drive-ins across the country are screening two films that have given audiences a look into her legacy, and we wanted to revisit them on today's show in her memory. One of those is the 2018 documentary RBG. It's directed by Julie Cohen and Betsy West. Got an Oscar nomination for Best Documentary Feature. I guess quickly, Christy, why don't you start with your thoughts about this documentary?
It's so great. It's so affectionate and so warm and yet really allows all the facets of Ginsburg's personality to shine through. You know, the intellectual rigor and the brilliance and the sharp mind and the stealthy kind of way she had with a zinger, but also the fact that she loved opera and gossip and could be playful and really warm. So it really captured the multitudes that she contained. It made me want to go to the gym because, like, at age 85, she's there with her little 3-pound weights working out with her trainer. And it's so necessary to watch this movie now if you have not already and just appreciate what she fought for and who she was.
And Lael, why don't you talk a little bit on The Basis of Sex, which is a narrative film starring Felicity Jones as the young Supreme Court justice.
Yes, pretty good biopic. Really, the doc is much better, but this was written by Ginsburg's nephew, Daniel Stiefelman, and it's really an affectionate portrait of her, and it also just shows the sort of domestic side of her life and everything she went through to get to where she was. Quite a strong performance by Felicity Jones.
So check your local listings to look up On the Basis of Sex and RBG. More to come on Film Week. Just ahead, my interview with the folks behind the upcoming film Nomadland. It's based on a book about older Americans who set out across the country in vans, RVs, and whatever vehicle they can afford looking for jobs. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app.